Addiction is a devastating problem that affects millions of Americans. It's hard to shake off the grip of alcohol or drugs, but recovery is possible. I'm Lauren Bavis, a reporter for Side Effects Public Media. Earlier this year, we sought out stories from people in recovery. Community members shared their battles with addiction at a live storytelling event in Indianapolis. Tonight, you'll hear those stories of grit, heartache, redemption, and hope. Our first story is from Nathan Boyer. He's 48 years old and has been in recovery for 4 years. Before starting recovery, Nathan says he had to hit rock bottom. That happened the day he fell off a ladder.
Hello, my name is Nathan and I'm an alcoholic. I'm 48 years old, and if I live to be 100, I'm never going to stop being amazed that I can say that out loud and even with a little bit of pride. I've been sober now a little over 4 years, which means I was a practicing alcoholic from the ages of 14 through 44, but I was probably born one. I just wasn't lucky enough to get that first drink till I was an adolescent. I've struggled with pretty bad anxiety my whole life, since I was a little kid. Of course, in the 70s, there wasn't really anybody around to tell that to me or explain it to me. All I knew, I was scared and lonely all the damn time. I was crazy, desperate for everybody in the world's approval, but never really brave enough to do anything to get it until I found booze. That stuff was like magic. Give me a few drinks and I was a whole new guy. Kind of a scary secret, and I almost hate telling people this, but it's true. Alcohol is excellent at reducing anxiety, short term. The fears I had of accomplishing average everyday goals got replaced by big dreams for my future, and begging for everybody's respect got replaced by expecting it. For Christ's sake, I could talk to girls. You know what I mean? I basically went from being a geeky little loner to a cocky popular kid through the power of alcohol. And I did this during a period of life where you're supposed to be developing healthy social skills and coping mechanisms. But I just skipped all that. No problem, though. I was happy, right? Usually. So why worry? But life kind of changes on you over time. And the teenage worries about anxiety turn into grown-up worries, like finances and careers, real love and family commitments. And that sort of thing gives healthy people anxiety. I didn't have a clue how to deal with any of it, at least not sober. And in addition to that, a little bit wasn't really going a very long way anymore, just like any chemical addiction. What started out as every weekend when I was at a party turned into every few days, which turned into first thing every morning. Now, this took decades to happen, but it was inevitable. Because the thing about alcohol is, as good as it is at attacking that anxiety in the beginning, it starts ratcheting up the anxiety later on, making it even worse. And in addition to that, your body builds up addiction, you know, or tolerance, rather. So, you know, you get to a point where you need a few drinks just to get back to what you used to call normal. Toward the end, I always had a bottle stashed under the seat of my car because I wouldn't need a refresher through the middle of the day. If I was home alone, and knock out a fifth of vodka 2 or 3 hours straight out of the bottle. You know that scene in Raiders of the Lost Ark where Karen Allen and the big Mongolian guy are having the drinking contest? Not in my league. Not even close. I regularly drove my grade school age children around when I was hammered. My wife, who loved me very much indeed, was on the verge of leaving me. Back in 2012, I lost my job because I was drunk at the office. I had worked at that company for 16 years and had been climbing the corporate ladder, but oh well. And a really astounding thing, in my mind, the drinking still wasn't the problem. And this is why when you're in an AA meeting, the only people that are allowed in the room is other addicts. Because anyone that has not experienced addiction has no clue the power of that pathological addiction. See, this all made perfect sense to me, because by this point, I had been professionally diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder. So that's my problem. Okay? All I need is to get a good prescription for that to go with the booze, and everything's going to be fine. You should have heard the way I kind of skirted around drinking when it came up in therapy sessions or talking to a doctor. Alcoholics are all Academy Award level actors, and they have to be because they're trying to convince even themselves. Then, in the spring of 2014, I had my moment. My 13-year-old daughter had been in a musical at school, and I volunteered to help break down the sets and stuff when everything was done because I'm so altruistic. So I showed up at school with my power tools and a pretty good drunk on, like most days. So I'm taking the roof off of a false storefront, and I fall off of a 10-foot ladder to the stage. And I bust my head open. I broke and dislocated my right shoulder, and I broke several ribs. And I did this in front of my 13-year-old daughter and her friends and their parents and her teachers. Now, remember the anxiety issues I was dealing with that started this problem, right? Well, both of my children, same problem, to one degree or another, all right? So can you imagine the horror and humiliation that little girl felt at that moment? I can. I did. And that was my moment of clarity. Not even my broken brain could justify any part of that. So 2 days later, my wife checks me into a rehab facility. I just didn't really have strength left to fight about it. I felt defeated. And honestly, I didn't think for a minute that I was starting a program of recovery. I didn't see any chance in hell that I was going to be able to quit. But I also didn't see any options. At that point, in my mind, I was either going to lose my family, my career, my life, if I didn't stop drinking, or I was going to lose myself and my happiness if I did. I mean, remember, at this point, I'd never spent any significant amount of time in my life happy with who I was when I was sober. I didn't even know how to be me without a drink. The way I looked at it, my problem was unique, right? Unique to the world. No one could possibly understand, let alone help. This disease is really good at telling you those kind of lies. And you believe them. You believe them right up until and sometimes even after you get hard proof otherwise. That's really one of the hardest things about this is in your mind, you're just utterly alone. You're weak and you're guilty and you're just too broken to fix. Otherwise, you would have fixed it on your damn own by now, right? So no one can understand. No one can help. Too broken to fix. Screw it. I'm going to have another drink. And I know there's people listening to this right now that can relate to that feeling. But as it turns out, I was wrong. I was very wrong. There are an awful lot of people that understand exactly what I was going through that have been where I was. And there's a lot of people that can certainly help. And the best thing is I was not too broken to fix. So I started the hardest thing I've ever done, with an awful lot of help from an awful lot of other people, because I could not do it on my own. And that's okay, because you're dealing with a disease that clouds your judgment and makes you lie to yourself every day. Of course you can't do it on your own. Oh, and once I took the alcohol out of the equation, I addressed the anxiety issues with therapy and medication that works if you don't wash it down with vodka. And I found out that I can be the man that I always wanted to be. I am still the man my wife fell in love with. I'm a better father than I ever was, and I'm just a better person in general. And these are all qualities in me that I've had my entire life but was never able to see on my own. Well, that's pretty much my story, and I hope telling this story lets somebody out there that has no hope, that doesn't see possibility, somebody that is too broken to fix, do something about it. And even more so, if you are that person right now listening to this, please take a leap, get the help. But if you're anything like me, you'll probably have to fall off your own ladder.
That was Nathan Boyer. He shared his story of recovery at a live event hosted by Side Effects Public Media. Our reporting sheds light on root causes of community-wide health problems, from chronic disease to mental health and addiction to infant mortality. And we talk to the people looking for solutions to those problems. For more information about Side Effects reporting and our work in the community, go to sideeffectspublicmedia.org. Tonight, you're listening to real experiences of addiction and recovery told by members of this community. Next, you'll hear from Dwight Fortune. Dwight is very active in the recovery community. He's part of a Trusted Mentors program, which helps people build life skills as they transition from prison to society.
So I want to tell you a story about how a green folder is the key to my success and my recovery. Now, before I get into that part of the story, I got to give you a little bit of background about me, correct? Just so you know where I'm coming from. See, I thought my story was unusual because I didn't have that regular story that you may think you hear about an addict where they grew up with a troubled home, abusive parents, drugs and alcohol all around. That was not my story. My life was awesome. I'm talking about phenomenal, great parenting. In fact, I didn't live the usual life of an addict. At least so I thought. Again, I keep saying so I thought. All through high school and into college, I was a great athlete. I was the captain of my baseball team. Went on to got a full scholarship to go to college, the D1 school, to play baseball. I graduated with an opportunity to go play pro ball. Now, a couple of that, because I got the beauty and the brawn, right, and the brains, because I also was all academics. I graduated with honors in high school and from college with a degree in accounting. When I graduated, I had opportunity, as I said, to go play pro ball, but I decided to go work for the government as an accountant. Now, government accountant is actually an oxymoron, if you know what I'm talking about. It shouldn't be in the same phrase, right? But that's what I did. I went to the government accountant. I was working there, and I decided, this isn't what I want to be. I had these grand dreams of how I wanted to create my life, what it wanted to look like. I wanted to be wealthy, successful. I wanted to be in the top four. I wanted to be on Forbes. That's what I wanted. So I left the government, and I started buying real estate. And I started getting more successful in real estate. I started partying even more. Because I'd gotten good at least I thought I'd gotten good at playing these two roles. One was the one I wanted you to see during the daytime. I was good. Matter of fact, when I was as high school and in college, I was the one that my friends' parents would say, "You need to be more like Dwight." Little did they know, I was the one influencing them to do all the other things at night. That didn't stop because I was still good at telling and spinning stories and talking myself out of situations. It wasn't that I didn't get caught a lot of times for the things that I was doing, but I knew how to talk my way out of it. And here I am with a little more money, a little more success, and my addiction is growing, and I got more money until about 9 years after I graduated from college. It's about 2011, and I'm sitting in front of a judge because I had failed probation once again, and I had to figure out how to get out of over 200 days of jail time. So I created this elaborate ruse, right? Me and my attorney put it together, right? The year before, I'd had a major accident where I had severed my spine, broken my hip, broken my lower leg, had road rash, all types of injuries, metal all through my body. So I'm like, I can't sleep on those hard cots, and I can't be in that atmosphere. I might get injured. It's part of my case. We also brought in a drug and recovery specialist who was going to vouch for me. He doesn't need to be going to jail. He needs to get recovery. Put on this whole elaborate ruse, and it worked. Instead of getting that 200 days of jail, the judge gave me 45. But before he gave me that 45-day sentence, he said to me, and for some reason the courtroom got quiet when he said it, and he was staring right at me, which is really freaking me out at the time. He says, you are too smart for your own good. Shoot, I got a 45-day sentence out of 200. I took that as a compliment. It worked. But here's the problem. Because I thought I was too smart for my own good, I wasn't really ever dealing with the problem. So 2 years later, in 2013, I get in trouble three times for the same crime on three different occasions, all felony convictions. You remember where I started? You would think with that upbringing that I should have a successful, I was on the track record for success, CEO or something. Matter of fact, one of my dope dealing friends told me, I thought you would be a CEO by now. Then he still sold me what he had it. So three felony convictions means three strikes rule. I should have got the full brunt of what the court could have sentenced me to. But for some reason, God saw fit for me to give me another opportunity. So again, we went through this whole thing with the court system and got me into a reentry program that was going to allow me to get in some recovery, and then it was going to dismiss all three of those charges. But the problem was they had a waiting list. So I had to sit in jail until my number got called. I'm in there for a couple months, go in front of the court, in front of the judge, go back, continue the case. 2 more months, go back, continue the case. 2 more months, go back, continue the case. This whole time, I'm trying to create a case for me to get out of here. So come about the 7th month, I'm about to go to court again. I'm like, today's the day. Today is the day. So I have this green folder. And in the green folder, I have on one side of it, I have all the programs I've been into, the recovery stuff, the men's ministry, the parenting classes I've been in. On the left side, I have all these letters and things that I've been working on, my psychology and on my emotions and so forth, that I'm writing and talking about the Bible study that I was leading while I was in jail. Like, I had this whole case put together to present to the judge. This is going to be the day. It's perfect. I'm ready. And on just for good measure, I'd written on the inside Psalms 23. I'd written out all Psalms 23. I kept reciting it over and over and over, just a mantra I was putting into my brain. I woke up that next morning excited to go to court. I was excited to go to court. The only people who are excited to go to court are people who are in jail. So I get to court, and I'm in the holding cell waiting to go to get my turn in front of the judge. So in front of the judge. And people are coming in, they're excited because they're getting shorter sentences and they're getting released. And if you know anything about being in front of the judge, another thing is you want the judge to be in a good mood if you're going to be in front of the judge. So today, obviously, is going to be a great day. I said my Psalms 23, I said it again, and then I walk into the courtroom. That's a lie. I had shackles on, I shuffled into the courtroom. But I shuffled in there happy with this green folder. I laid it down in front of me with a smile on my face. I'm looking at the judge like yes, just go do what you got to do. He starts running off the numbers from my court case, and they kept saying the numbers and saying the numbers and saying the numbers and saying the numbers. I had a lot of cases going on at one time. When he finished, he asked the prosecution, are you ready to proceed? They says, no, Your Honor, you must continue it again. I didn't even get a chance to present this case that I put together. They take me back to my dorm room, and as I'm walking in, I'm visibly upset, and the people I do Bible study come up to me because they're expecting me to have good news about being released. And I tell them, no, I'm not being released. I'm mad at God right now. Don't talk to me. So I go to my prayer closet. I had this basically little window that's cut out in there. I have my Bible open there, and I said, God, you and I need to talk, man. I'm mad at you. We need to talk. You need to tell me what's going on. Why am I still here? And I present my case to him the way I was going to present it to the judge. Look at all the stuff that I have done. Why am I still here? I got quiet and I waited because I needed an answer. I wanted an answer. And what I heard was, you weren't ready. And for some reason, I was willing to accept it that day. I turned from the window, grabbed my Bible, my journal, and started preparing the day's Bible study because I had to actually teach them or talk to them about why it was okay to be mad at God sometimes. But a couple months later from that, I was released from jail. I got into that reentry program, successfully completed it, and I've been clean ever since. Now, I say all this because the thing about me and addiction is that I thought I was smart enough to outthink the judges. Do y'all think the legal system? Do y'all think my addiction? But addiction doesn't care about your pedigree. It doesn't care where your background, how smart or dumb you are, how big or small, how tall or fit or whatever. It does not care. It comes to steal, kill, and destroy. I had to find something greater than everything that I gave. Because what I know is that I have to give my best and let God handle the rest. That's the only way that I actually became clean. I do my best and I give God the rest. You see, I stand before you a grateful recovering addict. A grateful recovering addict. Because that Psalm 23, yea, do I walk through the valley of the shadows of death, I shall fear no evil because God is on my side, is true in my life. With that, I hope this has been helpful to someone.
That was Dwight Fortune. You're listening to personal experiences of addiction recovery shared at a live storytelling event with SideFX Public Media. If you or a loved one would like to explore addiction treatment options, go to recoveryindiana.org. Recovery comes in all shapes and sizes, colors and backgrounds. Tonight, we have a broad representation of what recovery looks like. Our next story is from James, who asked that we identify him by his middle name. James is a paramedic. He's experienced addiction personally and watched how addiction can tear apart a family.
Three hundred ninety-four husbands, wives, and kids died at any given 48-hour period in 2017 from opiate overdose alone. That doesn't include any alcohol or other intoxicants. 394 also is strikingly close to what a 747 jumbo jet holds. Could you imagine a jumbo jet crashing every other day in our country right now and us not being more active in treating something that has to do with what's causing that crash? Fortunately for me, I was able to parachute to safety off of one of those planes, and today I'm going to share a little bit about my story. It has to do with some tragedy, triumph, and recovery, and finding a new way of life when I thought I was hopeless. I grew up in a upper middle class suburb around a major metropolitan area. Went to private schools, private tutors. Went to college, paid for by my parents, had a great life growing up. And I came home from college one day to visit a cousin who was long-term house-sitting my grandparents' house that had gone to a retirement home about 6 or 8 months prior. And as we rummaged through the cupboards for food, innocently enough in the kitchen, I remember finding a gallon baggie. And this gallon bag had a few pill bottles in the bottom of it. And we got out one of the pill bottles and read very strikingly on it. It said OxyContin. There were 20 pink pills in the bottom of that bottle that we took out. And I remember somehow I possessed the knowledge that if you took the coating off and basically took it via your nose, that it would get you high. And little did I know that that choice would forever change the trajectory of my life, essentially. At that point, I was an AB student in a college. I was a licensed scuba diver at 14, a licensed pilot at 17, a skydiver, a snow skier, a water skier. I mean, we all know how this narrative goes. A young, healthy, normal person goes off to college, finds drugs, and essentially starts to ruin their life. Now, it wasn't as fast as I anticipated. There was a lot of good times initially, but just like the grading curve at the university or at college, I rode the wave up and then sharply fell down at the other side. I remember that first day feeling the rush of the opioid. I mean, essentially, it was like a dopamine dump. I thought I'd won $10 million. My very nervous, calm, and reserved personality melted away. I was immediately charismatic. I was able to do and say whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted, and not have to think about how other people were perceiving me. At this time, I essentially was still doing well in school, and eventually, as time progressed, I found that I was substituting drugs and alcohol for basically my academic life. I went from being that AB student and actually initially being one semester 4.0 in college, might be by accident, but it did happen, to essentially I left my college ashamed and broken. I could not finish the last course. I had 3 credits, a managerial accounting class that I could not pass to get my bachelor's of science. I left there and I ended up taking a job in aviation as a pilot at the time. I found myself in Kuwait in 2006, and it was a dry country. I did not know that when I accepted the position. My boss says, "It's a dry country." I was like, "Yeah, I know, it's the desert." And he goes, "No, it's dry, like booze dry." And I laugh today, but at the time my stomach sank. I drank every day. I would have used opiates every day if I were able to find them, but I was not, thankfully, at that time. Long story short, I end up in a Middle East area where public executions are not uncommon, and I would routinely sneak alcohol and opiates in the belly of the plane to where I'm at because I didn't like dealing with the fear of living behind a 15-foot IED wall. I didn't like having to be x-rayed going into and out of my hotel room. I didn't like watching all the coffins of the troops that were killed. And instead of reaching out and talking to a mental health provider, I chose drugs and alcohol. I thankfully was only caught violating a visa infraction. I ended up in the back room of the Kuwaiti airport being grilled for multiple hours about why my visa had been expired for 6 months. And essentially that was so that I could continue to feed my drug and alcohol addiction at that time. I ended up coming back to the States and, essentially rode that wave down. And, I didn't find a bottom because I was arrested. I didn't find a bottom because I lost a bunch of stuff. I found a bottom because I hated who I became. I couldn't look at myself in the mirror. I could no longer have any self-respect or dignity. And I thought that I was going to die if I kept doing what I was doing, which motivated me to try to find another way. Essentially, the disease of addiction, if you drank and drug like I did, you chase everyone away unless they drank and drug like you do. And so when I got back to the States, I had one friend. It was my younger brother. And we drank and drugged together. And essentially, we chased everyone else out of our lives because we didn't want them to be in the way of what we did. It's a lonely, hellish way to exist, but that's how we existed. At some point, our family stepped in and asked me and all of us to intervene, a younger brother, and I told the interventionist, I'm his biggest using buddy. I am elbows deep in a drug and alcohol addiction, and I cannot find my way out. And so we had this intervention. The plan was for me to agree to go and him to follow suit and to go on to treatment, to do a detox and that type of thing. He decided to go it alone. August 20th of 2008, I jumped in the car with that interventionalist and went down to a treatment center. 7 days of hellish detox, 30 days inpatient, 9 months in a halfway house, and a lot of 12-step meetings. I found hope and I found a way out. Fast forward to a period of time, I'm probably 2 years sober at this point. Believe it or not, I was able to finish that bachelor's of science in my first try when I was sober, and became an EMT, and then a paramedic, and then eventually a firefighter paramedic, and essentially made a career Narcanning and helping those that drank and drug like I used to drink and drug. And I would help with harm reduction knowledge and help introduce them to 12-step meetings or to recovery or to anything I could do to help keep that addict or alcoholic alive for another day. One day I was on a shift about 15 minutes from my younger brother, and he unfortunately succumbed to this disease and didn't make it. He never got the chance to get the Narcan shot that I gave as a profession, and I carried that for a long time. But that is the reality of this disease: is some of us are chosen by chance, and some of us are not. you know, there's a lot of days that I think, man, I wish I could have been there to give him a shot. And then, you know, it is what it is. I remember stumbling into my home group. At this point, I was 3.5 years sober, and I just sat down bawling. And I remember saying, you know, it got him. And they had heard me talk about him for many years, and they knew what I meant. EMS was never really the same for me after that. I struggled on overdose runs. I struggled on any young person that was critically injured or ill. At that time, I didn't know anything about post-traumatic stress disorder regarding my time in the Middle East or being a first responder. I remember thinking to myself, why am I so paranoid? Why am I so hypervigilant? Why do I have these nightmares? Why do I see these dead people from the ceiling when the rafters that I walk into? And I didn't understand any of that. Eventually, closing in on 5 years sober, I had cut back on my meetings I was going to. I cut back on working with other alcoholics and addicts, and I cut back on service work. And then it happened. I had essentially a head full of lies about I wasn't that bad. I had a botched surgery, and I had a stomach full of pain medicine. And I ended up right back creating that hell on earth that I had clawed my way out of with the help of lots of fellow alcoholics and addicts. I essentially ended up back in treatment, another detox, a locked psych ward, a 30 days inpatient, and then some supportive living initially afterward, and lots of service work, and have been able to climb my way back out with all the help of those that I surround myself with. Today, you know, I live my life 24 hours at a time. I greatly accept and seek out a Vivitrol shot to help block the effects, the euphoric effects of opioids today. I try to spread harm reduction knowledge, and as a smart friend of mine that I know mentioned, constant low intensity work for a lifelong disease, and that's where I try to stay plugged in to the recovery community. Today, I have an awesome family, an awesome career, and an awesome life. 99% of the people I interact with in the medical community today have no idea that I suffer from opioid use disorder, and essentially, you know, I'm a product of a system of treatment and 12-step meetings and volunteering and guys that selflessly volunteered their time to me when I needed help. So it affects everyone from a millionaire and CEO to someone that's living underneath a bridge. You know, I am very grateful that I'm on the lifeboat and was able to parachute off of that plane because any many number of people today and even in our city will not make it. So I'm grateful to be sober. That's all I got. Thank you.
That was a story from James, a paramedic who asked to be identified by his middle name. He shared his recovery story at a live event with Side Effects Public Media. In Indiana, there is a shortage of services to treat women struggling with addiction. You'll next hear from Kelsey Phillips, who works with other women in recovery fighting to get care.
Hi, I am an addict called Kelsey. That's how I introduce myself where I belong. I am a woman in recovery, and in a sense, that makes me both one in a million and a million in one because women are heavily underrepresented in the recovery community. I think a lot of that is because as a woman in active addiction, I did everything women are not supposed to do. I stole. I was homeless. I lived under a bridge. I had children born addicted to heroin. And I was pretty unrepentant. I spent most of my young life being so resistant to the idea that I, because I am a woman, am vulnerable in some way that I wanted to become part of the boys' club. For me, I wanted to run as fast. I wanted to drink as much. And I don't make a liquor face, and I don't need chaser. I wanted to smoke like a man. I wanted to burgle like a man. And I felt like that was my way of never, ever having to be vulnerable again. What I didn't realize is that when, as a woman, I try to keep up with the men, I suffer other afflictions. I end up with a massive trauma history. I end up being chewed up and spit out. And a lot of that is the way that the world views women aside from addiction. So I try and keep up with the men, and I become a broken shell of a person who at some point is fighting in a war, right? So I have this friend who tells me that to surrender literally means to lay down my weapons and await further instruction. I love that. I'm not giving up. I'm not giving in. I'm just waiting. See, when I was using, I wasn't capable of surrendering and becoming vulnerable. But today I recognize that my vulnerability is my greatest weapon against addiction. It is my armor as a woman and as a recovering person. When I act in vulnerability, I am the antithesis of shame. See, I use drugs to feel good. But feeling good is such a small part of using drugs. It ends up being this exhausting process of robbing, of stealing, of begging, of borrowing, of burgling. I was a mom. I was a daughter. I was a thief, a shitty liar, and a shitty person. In the course of my addiction, I did many unloving things. I stole liquor from drugstores to sell to bootleggers. I was part of an infamous Bonnie and Clyde team that robbed motels with a steak knife. It's not very effective. I did lots and lots of silly things. But when I got into recovery and I embraced my vulnerability, I recognized that the women in the program had something I wanted. They seemed to be well-liked. They were parents. They were employed. They respected one another. Their quality of life at least appeared to be a lot higher than my own. And I became willing to do what they had done to get what they had gotten. Part of this process for me has been embracing that vulnerability, embracing all the things about myself that I had always tried to hide. The last time that I got high, September 10th of 2013, I got high in the bathroom of my child's kindergarten, sitting on a 1 foot off the ground potty. And I'm pretty sure everyone walking by could see me from underneath the door or from over the door. And I'll tell you what, I wasn't the kind of person who would have wasted a bag of dope on that experience if I had known it was going to be the last time I got high. But I got tired. I got really, really tired. I got tired of waking up every day saying, I'm not going to do this today, which inevitably ended in finding a way just to do it today so I could quit tomorrow. I got tired of waking up sick every day just to go to bed knowing I would wake up sick again the next day. After that day, I decided that I was going to do something different. Today, I work with addicts who are just being introduced to recovery. I work with women like me, women who have had children born addicted to heroin. I work with women who feel like they can never stay clean because they are nothing that society tells them they ought to be. I work with women who have limited access to treatment because they're expected to be at home taking care of domestic tasks, because they are not employed by employers who give good health insurance and are therefore woefully underinsured. I work with these people day in and day out, and in that I have found so much of my own serenity. I learn every day from my patients as much as my patients, I hope, learn from me. Today, I not only work in this field, but I'm also a parent to my three children by myself. I've been a full-time student for 5 years. I'm in grad school. I am gainfully employed. I have a real f-ing job, you guys. I also, I have a relationship with my mom. My children, they count on me. Before I got clean, my children didn't ask about me. They didn't care where I was. They knew I wasn't going to show up. In this process, I have become a parent again. I have a sponsor. When you get into 12-step recovery, they tell you to pick a sponsor who has what you want. I picked my sponsor because she was very well loved. And I said to myself, maybe I could be lovable. Today, I like to think I am. Maybe a little bit. So I guess what it really comes down to is that today I pay my own bills. I drag my own trash to the curb. So basically I'm living the dream. Thanks for letting me share.
That was Kelsey Phillips, a woman in addiction recovery. She shared her personal experiences at a live storytelling event hosted by Side Effects Public Media. Tonight's final story comes from Brandon Dryman. Brandon has been an Indianapolis firefighter and paramedic for 17 years. Brandon found that first responders face barriers when it comes to getting mental health and addiction treatment.
Thanks, everybody, for being here. Thanks to all the other speakers for sharing. I think we've probably all learned quite a bit tonight. My name is Brandon Dryman. I'm a firefighter paramedic with the Indianapolis Fire Department. I'm also the coordinator of the IFD Peer Support Program. I've been a firefighter in Indy for 17 years, but my story starts when I was 16. I grew up in Vincennes, Indiana. Has anybody here been to Vincennes by chance? A few people? Good. So, you know, that's small town USA. And growing up there, I had basically four heroes. I had Mr. Rogers and Cowboy Bob and Johnny Gage and Roy DeSoto. So we all know Mr. Rogers, right? Most people from Indiana know Cowboy Bob. Does anybody know Johnny and Roy? Fellow firefighter and back. What was that from? Does anybody know? Similar. It was a spinoff of that. It was from Emergency. So it was a show about firefighter paramedics. And it was because of that that I decided to do what I do now. I had a very strong impression. So when I turned 16, I joined the local volunteer fire department. And I also started driving ambulances. At that time, you just had to be 16. I don't know what the current regulations are. But again, small town, I was certified in first aid and CPR. And that kind of began my journey in public safety. I turned 18, went to EMT school, got my EMT cert. And started doing that, paid my way through through college bills that way. And progress on to the current time, became a career firefighter, went to paramedic school, and that brings us up to the current time. But over that 28-year period, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things, particularly at such a young age, at 16, that I was not ready to deal with on any level. And first responders generally don't talk about the things we see just because they're hard to describe, but it is a difficult job. And I didn't process that very well at all. I had behavioral health issues, but because of the stigma, which has come up so many times, I was not going to reach out for help, period. And rather than seeking out that professional help, I used, you know, I was too macho. I was too tough. I don't need that stuff. I can handle this. Everybody else is handling it, right? What do they do? Well, we drink a lot. So that's what I did, too. And I lived with severe alcohol use disorder for a long time, a number of years, until 2012. And it's interesting that 2012-2013 mark has kind of been popular in here tonight. But I came to work, regular day on shift. My captain stuck his head out of the office window and said, hey, you've been picked for a random drug screen. Head down and get your drug screen done. And that also included a breath test. And I remember joking as I walked out of the firehouse, all the other guys were sitting at the table. And I said, hey, I guess I won't be seeing you guys for a while, tongue in cheek, because I thought I was going to be fine. I wasn't intoxicated. But my tolerance was so high that it didn't matter. I had drunk so much the night before that when I had that breath test, I still had alcohol in my system at 9 o'clock the next day. So that's when, like, everything just kind of hit. And again, that ego that kept me from getting help in the first place kicked in again. You know, this, how can this be happening? I've been paramedic of the year and received awards for rescues I've been part of and finished first in my fire academy class, first in paramedic school, all those things. But we heard Dwight mention it and other speakers that these illnesses, these diseases don't care. They don't discriminate. And it doesn't matter how good you are at your job or what you've accomplished. If you have behavioral health problems and you try to ignore them or you try to self-medicate, eventually they catch you. They've got all the time. And that's what happened to me. So as a result of that, I was suspended. But I also had a great opportunity to enroll in our employee assistance program. And I took advantage of that. And I had a really, really great counselor. Has everybody seen Good Will Hunting? He was just like Sean, like the Robin Williams character, which is a perfect fit for me. That's exactly what I needed. And he you know, worked with me the lines of getting sober. My wife was also a big help. Just telling somebody that you're proud of them. Means a lot. So, excuse me. So that was 6 years ago, and I'm going to admit it. So that's how I got involved in peer support, because I knew it wasn't just me. There were a lot of people having the same problem. And with peer support, the beauty of it is it's a firefighter helping a firefighter or a cop helping a cop. And somebody can come and talk to me about their problem, their addiction, without judgment. That's not my goal. I'm in no place to judge. And they can talk to me confidentially and get the help they need. And as a result of that, I can't even count the number of people just in Indiana and Indianapolis that our team has helped. And a big part of that is because the Indianapolis Fire Department takes behavioral health seriously. Chief Malone has made it a priority to make a whole separate division in the Indianapolis Fire Department just to do this. And we travel the state to help anybody we can. It also gave me the opportunity to get involved with the International Association of Firefighters. And we go out and teach 30 firefighters at a time how to set up their own peer support programs. And that's really where the beauty of recovery comes in. Because I'm just one guy, but I can teach 30 people how to do this. And then those 30 people talk to 30 people or 50 people. Or 100 people. And it just spreads from there, that ripple effect, just from one dude getting sober. And something I never thought I would do is go around the country and giving lectures and presentations and being part of panels where I normally don't cry. but I never thought I would do that. But again, it's that ripple effect of how many people hear those lectures and go back to their departments and their administrators and make changes for the better because of that. And I know that sounds like a lot of I and me. And I just want to be really clear that it's not Nothing that I'm doing is a result of me. I was given a second chance. Everything that I've been able to accomplish and the people to help have been because of, in my life, three big things that got me there. The first was the Indianapolis Fire Department saw more in me that day than I saw in myself. And they didn't just throw me out of the way. They said, we want you to get better, and they gave me the route to do it. Second, I had access to really high-quality behavioral health care from somebody who cared, who understood me, and showed me compassion. And that, unfortunately, is not a luxury that a lot of people have. And finally was my wife, and she has stuck with me in the dark times and through my recovery, and even now, not just sticking by me, but encouraging me to do the things that I can do to help other people get better. And I just think, I look at those and I think, how many jobs have been saved? How many families and marriages have been saved? How many lives have been saved because of those three people, those three groups? And to me, that is really the beauty and the power of love and recovery. So thank you for listening to my story. I appreciate it.
Addiction impacts millions of Americans every day. For addiction treatment information and resources, go to recoveryindiana.org. Thank you for listening to these stories of recovery and hope. For more information about side effects reporting and work in the community, visit sideeffectspublicmedia.org. Special thanks to Brandon George, director with the Indiana Addictions Issues Coalition, and Robin Tate Rockle with Side Effects for organizing our live event.